It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When we see an acquaintance, it's common practice for us to ask, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Well, one person tracks those answers countywide. Karen Hacker is the director of the Allegheny County Department of Health, and she joins us in studio now. Dr. Hacker, welcome to the confluence. So let's find out, how are we doing countywide?
Well, I think we're doing a little better than when I arrived, but we still have a lot of challenges. We still have a lot of gains that we would like to be making.
Okay, so I'm going to get into some specific challenges and gains. So we're doing a little better. I remember when you started, I can't believe it's been 5 years already because it was September of 13. And if it wasn't the number one priority, you did list as a definite priority obesity. Is that still the case, a top priority? Has it shifted or not?
Unfortunately, we haven't seen much change in particularly adult obesity. And as you probably know, there was a recent Robert Wood Johnson report that came out that said Pennsylvania is pretty much hanging in there at about 30% of the population. And we look very similar. Obesity is a pretty challenging indicator to change, and it really requires multiple interventions, including things like access to healthy food, as well as how people choose their food and what they eat and exercise and all those types of things. So we have been, you know, we launched our Live Well Allegheny campaign relatively early in my tenure, and we are still focusing on moving that forward.
I want to ask a basic question. Has the definition among scientists, among medical professionals about obesity, has it changed at all? Can it be misleading? We used to always hear that, you know, your height is this, your weight should be this, and if you're X amount of pounds above or percentage above that target weight, then you are considered obese. Has it changed? And number two, how do you factor in if a lot of that weight or maybe additional weight is musculature, is muscle?
Well, I think you're probably talking about the BMI,
right,
which is something that we use now. We no longer use the height and weight statistics that we used to use 10, 15 years ago. So the BMI is really the gold standard now. But you're absolutely right. For example, they consider an adult to be obese if their BMI is over a certain level. I think it's 30, if I'm correct. But if you're an athlete, and most of that is muscle mass, then there actually is an athletic BMI that people will account for. I think that these are ultimately help us understand the standards and sort of where healthy weight is. And if you know it, there's quite a large range. So they're not expecting an individual to be ultimately at one particular level. But with that said, I don't think it takes a lot to look around to understand that our girth is increasing in general. You know, go into a store and you'll see larger and larger sizes. You know, I'm shocked. I have not lost weight recently, and I seem to go down in size all the time. And I think it's just that the manufacturers are somehow changing those.
Psychological to make you feel
exactly
better.
Exactly. But, you know, this has been a challenge for this country for really since the 70s. We've been seeing this uptick.
Right. You mentioned the 15th annual State of Obesity Report by Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that was released this month. I believe Pennsylvania was middle of the pack, 25. No real movement in terms of adult obesity. When you arrived, you also put an emphasis on childhood obesity. In 5 years, can you see any change there yet?
We really haven't been able to see much of a change. Doesn't seem that it's going up, but we're not seeing the downward trend to the extent that we would like to see it. So we just recently received a very small grant to work with a whole group of folks who are in this space to talk about what are we missing here. Is it simply that we don't have enough of these interventions? Is it that it just takes an enormous amount of time? Or is it that there are things that we're missing that perhaps some of the states that are in the higher percentiles are actually implementing?
Does it take a while to build up those good habits or get rid of the bad habits in the sense you say we sort of are where we're at? We're almost flat. Is that almost, in a sense, a little bit of progress? If you want to be optimistic, half full glass. And then so you flatten, and then maybe you start
I think that's right, that you hope to see a stabilization, if you want to see it, and not that continued increase prior to seeing the downward trend. But with that said, you know, these are very complex issues. You know, obviously there's the individual and what the individual decides to put in their mouth. There's the availability of what surrounds that individual and what is easy to get. You know, certainly it's very easy to get fast food in some of our communities. It's much harder to get healthy food. You know, we call them fast food oases, if you want to think of it that way, where you might have a healthy food desert in the same exact place. And these often tend to be communities that are already struggling with various issues, particularly economic issues, where fast food seems to get a real foothold. And we know that those are very calorie dense, high fat, lots of starch, lots of carbohydrates, none of which are going to help an individual lose weight. On the other hand, also lifestyle plays a part, right? How difficult is it during the day? You know, can you actually bring a lunch to work, for example? Is that something that you would consider? What are the places around you where you might get food access during that day? You know, one of the concerns I often had for kids is that they're often working, particularly teenagers, maybe working in fast food, and they eat at the end of their shift. And what do they eat at the end of their shift but the food from that purveyor?
Right.
And then they go home and go to sleep. So worst time of the day to eat is right before you go to sleep because you don't burn anything off at all, right? So some people said if you could just shift what you eat it for dinner to breakfast, you'd actually probably lose weight. It doesn't give the body any opportunity to burn it off. So there's so many variables that are involved here, and I think we're trying to hit a lot of them that have to do with what do people surround themselves with.
The study that we alluded to also, the data shows that African Americans and Hispanics are more likely to be obese. The obesity rate is higher than white residents. Is this a racial ethnic? Is there a racial ethnic component to this? Or is it a socioeconomic, you know, a lower income aspect to it that you can't afford the healthier foods?
Well, certainly we know that there is absolutely a correlation between socioeconomic status and obesity, regardless of racial ethnic variables.
Right.
However, we do also find that there's that racial ethnic groups that are have higher proportion of individuals who are obese. Some of this may be choices in terms of food, in terms of the types of food within that community that tend to be eaten. Some of it may also be body image within that population and how people perceive body image. You know, some populations perceive that differently than others. But all told, I think that a lot of it does have to do with access. And unfortunately, many of our African-American individuals, particularly in Allegheny County, are also living in some of our more impoverished communities.
Early in your tenure, you began a program to address health concerns at the community level, as well as the individual level. Residents of those communities, Live Well Allegheny. Are there any solid results yet? How do you measure that?
Well, so part of how we measured is just how many communities, how many community schools, how many businesses have joined, and we've continued to see an upward trend there. We're now at 61 communities that have made commitments to surround their populations with healthier choices. We just did the last one, Bradford Woods, I believe, was on Saturday. And as you know, we have 130 municipalities in Allegheny County, so we still have a way to go. But with each of those, we're hopeful that there will be more opportunities for healthy living, and it's really this concept of a culture of health. Now, the question of how do you actually measure it is really going to be in those numbers. How many people smoke? How many people are getting physical activity? And how many people are still ranking in those obese categories? And we measure that by doing a variety of surveys. Those are quite expensive, and we can't do them on a consistent basis because of that. It's also self-report, so take it for what it's worth. But that is a lot of how the reports, for example, that Robert Wood Johnson got, that's the data that they're using to depict the country.
Right. obesity isn't the only concern that we have about our children. Something else that has come to the forefront, especially in the last really couple of years, lead levels in children. There was some good news in your most recent report on that issue. More kids being tested, percentage of those with lead levels above the state set level for medical intervention has dropped. So are we as a community doing something right, and what do we still need to do?
Well, as you know, we passed a universal lead screening ordinance that went into effect in January, and it is having results. We're screening a lot more children. The rates themselves are drifting downwards. I will not tell you that they have, in the last year or so, have dropped substantially. But if you look at us compared to 10 years ago, we've seen a real decrease. Now, with that said, we're also picking up more children who actually have those elevated lead levels. The rates, as you said, go down, but that's over a population and the actual individuals. And that's exactly what we had hoped to find, that we would identify children early. I think that there's a number of things that people are aware of now. Number one, I think that doing the universal screening does make people a lot more aware of the fact that lead is ubiquitous in our environment.
And it's not just in our water, it's in the soil, of course, heard for years in the paint and the like.
Correct, correct. So one of the things we're really interested in is to make that next leap, we really need to do this concept of primary prevention, which is how do we either get into homes and have people do the remediation necessary before the child ever gets exposed. People have talked about lead-safe homes and how do you achieve that. We literally are talking to some communities right now about whether they could pilot some of those types of strategies connected to their certificate of occupancy program, so they already have inspectors. But I also think it's a lot about educating the public. I came from Massachusetts where we had been doing lead screening on children mandatory for decades. It just was something as a parent you assumed. And when you were doing renovation in your home, for example, you made sure to clean properly, to keep your children away from the dust, and even potentially to get them tested if you were concerned. So I think some of this is increasing the awareness of what's going on, as well as doing the actual work to get as much of the lead out of the places that expose children as possible.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to get to some air quality questions, but one more about lead. Is it a challenge to actually get into homes for the testing?
Absolutely. You know, people are not particularly enthusiastic about folks coming into their homes. I think there's concerns about whether or not that might mean some risk to their children. I think that there are also just concerns about what it means for the cost that they might have to pay in terms of fixing the home. We would hope that people would be a lot more open to this. And we are working with a number of community organizations that I think really have the touch points in communities to try to improve that.
Okay. Not unexpectedly, when the American Lung Association released its annual air quality report, the Pittsburgh region was among the worst. Allegheny County received F grades for ozone, daily fine particulate, and long-term particulates. This has been an ongoing battle for years. Is it a losing battle?
Absolutely not. We are going to keep working towards getting our best air quality possible. And as you probably know, we just levied a very high fine on U.S. Steel, Claritin Coke Works, and basically expected them to clean up some of those emissions to the tune of, if they don't do that, we'll put their batteries in slow idle, which is not something that they want to hear. That is currently going through the legal hearing process, as you probably know, so we don't have answers yet. But I think the enforcement action, you know, we passed a new civil penalty regulation in our own shop that actually increases the fines if they're repetitive fines over time. So those are some of the things that we're doing. And I hope that the U.S. EPA, as you probably know, most recently we had a public hearing 2 days ago. Right. Those are some of the things that are of great concern to us, that if there's an unraveling of the current standards, that could pose particular challenges for us.
Right. In our remaining 2 minutes, have your plans, your overall long-range plans for the overall health of this county, have they been altered, slowed down, sidetracked at all by the opioid crisis?
Well, the thing about public health is you never quite know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And so part of our jobs is to address the concerns that come up. And we have put a huge amount of our energies into the opioid epidemic and addressing that. there's some hopeful news. We're not sure, and I hate to, you know, put that out there and then find that the end of the year statistics don't bear out. But right now we are on the road to actually seeing a fairly steep decrease in the number of deaths in the last year. Mm-hmm. But that means that we still have way too many, and we still will continue our work.
All right. We started this conversation with when you came on board 5 years ago as Allegheny County Health Director. So what do you want to, in our remaining minute, what do you want to accomplish in your next 5 years? What's going to be number one or number two on that priority list?
Well, I think air quality is obviously up there. I think the tides have turned in terms of the whole population of the community and their demand for this. But I also would love to see the obesity rate go down, and I'd love to see the smoking rate down. One of my pet peeves right now is that I feel that our current Pennsylvania Clean Indoor Air Act is nowhere near strong enough, and I'd really like to see those exemptions removed.
Well, and there is legislation to remove those exemptions. Do I assume that you'll be lobbying state lawmakers to do that?
Well, I don't think we're allowed to lobby in state government, but we will encourage and educate. Absolutely.
Very good. Dr. Karen Hacker is the director of the Allegheny County Department of Health. Karen Hacker, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, Pennsylvania has fairly lenient siting requirements for natural gas pipelines that flow through its soil. But what does that mean for homeowners whose property abuts those lines? We'll get the latest from State Impact Pennsylvania's new series on the Mariner East 2 pipeline. And are voters willing to approve a tax hike on themselves for early learning and after-school programs for children? The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence and wherever you get your podcasts. Stick with us on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Kathleen Davis. Four current and former employees of the Mattress Factory Museum have filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. They say museum leadership downplayed allegations of sexual assault perpetrated by a museum employee. And they say they were retaliated against after they spoke up against the alleged assaulter. And a voter registration event on the University of Pittsburgh's campus Tuesday was headlined by actor Tom Hanks. He urged young Pennsylvanians to bring a friend to the polls on Election Day. For more trending stories, visit our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. The Mariner East 2 pipeline is expected to open this month and will carry natural gas liquids through some of the most densely populated parts of the state. But companies that own pipelines, like the Mariner East and the one that recently exploded in Beaver County, have few regulations over where these pipelines can be built. As part of a State Impact Pennsylvania series, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports some want to change that.
Chuck Belzik is in his backyard, pointing through some trees down a hill.
So you can kind of see the top of that black right there, way at the end of the tree line down there, just probably, 50 yards or so.
He's pointing to a wall behind his house in Center Township, Beaver County. Beyond that wall is the Revolution Pipeline, a 24-inch gathering line owned by Energy Transfer Partners. Not far from where we're standing, it blew up in early September. Belzik said it sounded like a bomb went off.
You know, something that you don't ever want to hear when you, in your lifetime. It shook the whole neighborhood. It really did.
The pipeline had only been online for a week when officials believe a landslide caused by heavy rains led to the explosion. The fire destroyed a neighbor's home, but no one was hurt. Belzik said he didn't like that the pipeline was built so close to his house.
It is, but I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, this is where you live, and, you know, if we owned the property, it might have been a different story. You know, we had no say-so what goes on.
It turns out no one, no federal, state, or local government, has much of a say-so in where pipelines like this one can go. That's because of a hole in the patchwork of federal and state regulations that oversee pipeline construction. A pipeline route that crosses state lines has to get federal approval. But the Revolution doesn't cross state lines. It only carries gas from Butler County to Washington County. For those Pennsylvania-only pipelines, state regulations only come into play when the route crosses a stream or wetland. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission is the state's main regulator for pipelines and oversees things like safety and construction standards. But it says state law doesn't allow it to oversee pipeline siting. Andrew Place, the vice chairman of the commission, thinks the PUC, or some state agency, should have the power to do that, just like it does with overhead power lines.
From my perspective, my individual perspective, I don't draw a distinction.
He says this would give more say to local communities and allow the state to take a more global look at pipeline routes so that it can minimize their impacts.
You can look at these broader questions. All right, let's look at a 100-mile-wide pathway. What's the most protective of the environment and human health path you can take?
A bill introduced by State Senator Andrew Dinneman of suburban Philadelphia would give the PUC this ability. Dinneman said his concern grew out of constituent complaints that the Mariner East pipeline goes too close to schools, libraries, and houses in his district.
And because the state has no siting authority, the PUC essentially lets the pipeline be built wherever the company wants it to be built.
Dinneman said oversight from the PUC would allow the public to comment on projected pipeline routes and push the commission to implement stricter safety measures in densely populated areas.
Hopefully, by granting some siting authority, it will force the PUC to ask the questions they should be asking anyway.
But it's unclear how far this idea will go. Dinneman's bill remains stuck in committee. Dave Spiegelmeyer, president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition, an industry trade group, opposes the bill. He says pipeline companies try to keep their routes away from sensitive areas. Spiegelmeyer says natural gas brings economic benefits and has helped displace dirty coal as a power source.
The benefits are extraordinary, and we can't find ways to slow its development. We should be encouraging its development.
Back in Beaver County, Chuck Belzik says even if there were more oversight over where pipelines can be built, he's not sure it would do much to keep them away from his neighborhood.
How far do you push that? You know, are you going to win the battle in the long run? And all it's going to do is just cost you time and money. That's the bottom line. I mean, how do you fight that?
Whether he likes it or not, he says he's got to live with the pipeline behind his house. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Find the entire series online at State Impact Pennsylvania, which is a collaboration among WESA, WHYY, WITF, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Allegheny County Children's Fund Initiative wants county residents to vote November 6th to increase their own property taxes to support after-school, early learning, and nutrition programs for children. We're going to talk about the need, but also the idea of voters deciding to boost their own taxes with Patrick Dowd. He's Executive Director of Allies for Children and a member of the steering committee for the Allegheny County Children's Fund. Patrick, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Also, Eric Montardi, Research Director of the Allegheny Institute for Public Policy. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about the ballot question itself and how it would work, Patrick, the initiative itself implies that there is a shortage of funds, a shortage of support to cover those needs I alluded to, yep. After-school programs, early learning, as well as nutrition programs. So that's it? There's a shortage or what?
So if we look across Allegheny County, there are a large number of kids who don't have access to early learning, who don't have access to after-school programs. We could talk about 6,700 kids who are eligible for Head Start, early learning, pre-K counts, things of that sort, where there are not slots available. And if we could look up the income level, that's going to also be the case. Even more kids. If we look at after-school programs, we're serving approximately 23 to 25, maybe 28% of the population of kids that are eligible. 72% of parents recently polled said, yeah, we would like to have access for our kids. And there are still tens of thousands of kids. It's hard to imagine this. Tens of thousands of kids in Allegheny County who are at risk for hunger each and every day. The money that we spend on these programs here in Allegheny County, almost completely from state and federal sources. So 100% of the money that we spend on early learning, state and federal funding. 100% of the public money in food, state and federal sources. The county does contribute some amount of money to after-school programs. These are programs, for example, BJWL, which serves kids in public 16 public housing sites around the county, things of that. So it's highly targeted and really focused, but there's a lot more that we could be doing for kids in the county.
Eric, you analyze, you know, cost, public policy, government policy. So is there a sense, what do you look at when you're looking at Allegheny County and its expenditures as compared to the state on programs such as the after school and the early learning that Patrick was mentioning?
Well, I mean, Allegheny County's budget itself, I mean, the majority of what it spends is on human services. I mean, it is a pass-through entity as a county, as many other counties in Pennsylvania, for federal and state dollars related to human services. And then it, you know, carries out the other functions that, you know, the counties are mandated to do in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
So the question is, so you take that budget. The last time I looked, it was the Allegheny County budget was more than $800 million. Mm-hmm. Is it... Well, the budget should be larger, or it should be a reappropriation, a shifting of funds to meet priorities that are not being emphasized.
So if we think about the budget for the county, right, as Eric said, it's a pass-through. There are about $800 million coming in through through state and federal contributions, for mainly for human services, and you have an additional $800 million that are operated for the basic services that are mandated by the Commonwealth. We believe that this is complementary to that work. We think that it's really important that the county make these investments and that we make them strategically across the county. As Eric knows, I do a lot of work looking at school districts and looking at the investments that we make here in the county, and we aren't able actually to make those strategic investments from positions of particular school districts. Having this positioned in the county complements the work that's happening, for example, in DHS, but it also allows us to be strategic and make sure kids around the county are getting the kind of investments in programs that are proven to work. This is the other thing. These are proven programs that we know work for kids, and they provide benefits not just for the kids, but back to the community as far as savings and good value.
Well, I think on your point of could you reprioritize what the county does, I mean, there are processes the county is supposed to carry out. I mean, it does do a sunset review every 4 years. I mean, they basically have staggered it now, so they're, you know, something that's, you know, departments and agencies are coming up every year. So there could be an argument that made, say, go to county council and say this is, you know, a priority that we'd like to see happen, and through the sunset review process, say, could we reallocate money? I mean, I think that was your sort of your point or your line of questioning there. Could you do it? All government be doing that, you know, to figure out, are we providing the essential services? What are the things that are not core to the level of government service that we're providing? What can be, you know, spun off to somebody else, basically? I think that should be always an ongoing process.
And in this project, I think one of the things, sort of to Eric's point, one of the things that we think is really important is we're not doing this through the legislative process, which is possible. We're rather taking it out to the people. The people of the county were the ones that voted in this Home Rule Charter in 1999, and we're proposing an amendment to that Home Rule Charter because we think that it merits that level of consideration, that you take it directly to the people. So we gathered over the summer 63,000 signatures to qualify the question for the ballot, and now our hope is that it's going to be on the ballot. Our hope, obviously, is that people vote yes. But our true intention here is for us to have a discussion. What are the priorities for the region, the county in this case, as it relates to kids? And let's have that discussion. And we do, by the way, just to be consistent with what Eric's saying about review, in the Home Rule Charter amendment that we've called for, and that's essentially on the ballot, there will be a five-year review every year of the priorities of this fund if it were approved by the voters on November 6th.
Is the overarching question, the ballot question aside, do we put enough emphasis on our children in this county?
Well, I think from our perspective, we try and do as much as we can, but the idea here is to start to think about how we can be more strategic in that. So we clearly need the resources. The resources are not there. We can go through that data and talk about that. But second of all, when we're making these investments, we want to make it strategically across the county. There's need in the city. There's need in parts of the county. Let's start to analyze that and create an office and a fund that are going to allow us to do the kinds of work, just what Eric's saying, to be strategic in our thinking and make sure that we're meeting the priorities that we as the people of the county has set up for ourselves. That's why the referendum process and the mandates that we have from the state and federal governments, as Eric was talking about, the funds that come through.
Eric, I know your organization, Allegheny Institute, looks at, analyzes investments and spending by different public entities, whether it's Port Authority or on pensions, et cetera, et cetera. Do you look at investments in social service programs and the effectiveness of them?
Not so much. I mean, we, again, are a think tank that's focused on local government. So obviously, as mentioned already, the county does have a large human service function to it. Municipalities, school districts, authorities, you know, there you're talking about a blend of, you know, general purpose and then specific purpose governments that in some cases they're carrying out one thing. Again, I think that, you know, just looking at an evaluation process of what's done specifically for human services, we haven't done much of that, in recent years. I mean, we're just looking mostly at, you know, where the budgets are, where the money's coming from, you know, how effective are some of the programs that, you know, are proposed or that are being carried out. But that large component, you know, not so much.
Okay. So if approved, this is would raise the property taxes by 0.25 mils, which translates to if you own a home, you own a property that's valued at $100,000, it means an extra $25 per year on your real estate taxes. Who's going to administer? Yeah. Are we adding another layer of bureaucracy, though?
Yes, that's a great question. So around the country, there are about 25 or 30 funds that are very similar to this, put in mostly by the public referendum process. And when we did our research, you know, starting about 2 years ago, looking into all those funds, one of the core elements that we learned from best practices from those folks, and these, by the way, would be sort of the usual suspects for referenda, a lot of West Coast communities, so San Francisco, Portland, Seattle. But interestingly, the state of Missouri is the leading state as far as the number of communities, counties in their state that have created these things. So when we went and talked with these folks, they all recommended the creation of a small specific office responsible for the administration of these funds, specifically because it creates a high level of visibility. These funds would, in our amendment, these funds would be segregated into a special account in the county government. So currently they have a debt service account, they have a general fund through which almost all the money flows. We would be adding, if the public approved, an additional fund, the children's fund, that would be administered by a small office, imagine three or four people, approximately 3%, no more in certain years where you have to do strategic planning and things like that.
3% of the budget?
Of the budget, yeah.
Okay.
No more than three. Some communities, when they do things like strategic planning or that five-year evaluation, they'll increase that number to 4%, maybe 5%, depending on the size of the fund and the work that has to get done. But anyway, yeah, it's a separate office. And the one last thing, you want to keep it distinct from these other offices because the mission is different. It doesn't mean that they can't be aligned or they can't share the governmental infrastructure of various processes, payroll, et cetera. But you want to keep it distinct and separate for visibility and accountability from the public.
Well, I mean, you know, if it gets approved and then it's in the charter and then the fund is set up and the office is set up, I mean, yeah, I guess we just have to then you have to monitor and say, okay,
exactly.
Yeah, how much is being spent on the administration of it? The thing about, you know, the questions on the ballot is we don't have a lot of history with that here in Allegheny County. This would be the first question countywide under the charter to increase the property tax, the county property tax. There's been a couple of examples of other places. You know, the city had the library referendum, which, you know, Patrick's we are very familiar with. There was a referendum in Bethel Park on firefighting service. There was a referendum this past May on security measures in Chartiers Valley School District. So two of those were approved, one failed. Here we're again getting to the point where, you know, just last November, there was a statewide ballot question on, do you want the legislature to give the local governments permission to basically wipe out homestead property taxes? That didn't pass in Allegheny County, but it did pass statewide.
That's right.
So now we're coming up to the point where a year later we're asking, do you want to increase your property taxes for, you know, the purposes of this fund?
All right, Patrick. So Eric just mentioned you were heavily involved in that one, I believe it was 2011.
Exactly.
It was to really help out libraries, and that was just citywide.
Right.
And that passed overwhelmingly, I believe it was a 71% yes vote, as I recall. Is there any concern that this is now a countywide referendum? Does that sort of change the game?
Well, it does change the game in the sense that you have a different vote base. But I think, you know, Eric's right. We don't have a long and deep experience with this. But given the fact that the county approved the Home Rule Charter in 99, and in order to create this fund, we're calling for a charter amendment. We think that it's appropriate that it goes out to the public. We think it's appropriate that the public be the one to make this decision. And for us, it's really important to have this conversation about what our priorities are. I think we've found a lot of positive response, but we still have a long way to go as far as communicating everything to the public. This is very hard work to do, and we'll continue to do that. But for us, those of us that have been working on this for a while, this is really about establishing a conversation. We hope that this is the beginning of what becomes year over year over year, a long conversation about what are our priorities for kids in the region and how are we meeting the needs that we know. And really focusing, again, I just want to emphasize this, on programs that are proven to work. If we look at the county budget and we think about what's happening inside of the county, we're doing work on in some ways related to these programs, but we're really not tackling some of the larger issues and larger challenges. So, and we think about early learning and what it means as far as preparing kids for getting into kindergarten and 12th grade systems and helping them get ready to read and read by third grade and on track for high school graduation, things like this. This is essentially sort of wrapping around the work that we're already doing and the investments we're already making in public education. So we think that that's really critical.
We have just 3 minutes left. I want to get to this. And so you talked about 3% sort of administrative costs. I believe it's $13 million you're hoping to generate.
We believe it's about $18 million.
$18 million. Okay. So, Eric, will you be keeping an eye on, you know, just how effective this is, that the money is getting to the programs, to the kids that really need it?
It has to be part of it. I mean, and again, right now in the Home Rule Charter, you have the sunset review process. That is in the charter so that the manager is supposed to review all the functions and departments of the county government every 4 years. Those recommendations go to the council. I think this is the important thing about amending the charter, is that that is a different thing from an initiative which would, you know, basically go in front of the council, or a referendum to approve an ordinance, because then after 2 years, the council could basically say, we don't want this and we can amend it, or the county executive could do it. To get something into the charter and then to get it out, basically the opposite of the process, or the same process. You'd have to collect the requisite number of signatures, put it on the ballot. So it is something that needs to be looked at. And again, as Patrick is, you know, saying here about a countywide vote, I mean, this is a little bit of making the county in the position of carrying out functions that would be public education related, with after-school programs, early learning, almost things that the school districts should be carrying out. I mean,
I might disagree with that.
Think about, you know, this fiscal year, you know, out of the 43 school districts in Allegheny County, 27 of them increased their property taxes. So it's not only watching, you know, if this were to be approved and then put into the county's budget, and it's a fund and it's an office and it's a distribution formula, all of the things that go with that, but it's also then what are the school districts doing on those functions as well?
We have 1 minute left.
Really quickly, so this is designed to support and enhance the work that's happening in the K-12 system. You know, pre-K is literally before kindergarten, and after school is literally after the day. These are things that are outside the mission. And again, school districts are working hard to meet their budgets, and they're focusing on the mission K-12 during the classroom time. Our goal is here to actually build support around that, and we don't see this as usurping or taking or any of the words that might fit in there, the responsibilities of school districts, but rather partnering with and serving in the same, towards the same mission, and beginning to see that there are other places where we need to be doing this work in support of kids. It's not all relegated to the school districts, and, you know, county and municipal governments as well have a role in making sure that our kids are getting what they need in order to thrive here in Allegheny County. And ultimately, this, if you think about it from a workforce investment standpoint, we were just talking about that outside with our kids. We definitely want to make sure that our kids are prepared to do the kind of work that's in the 21st century, and these kinds of investments are critical to that end.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Patrick Dowd is Executive Director of Allies for Children, a member of the Steering Committee for the Allegheny County Children's Fund. Eric Montardi is a Research Director for the Allegheny Institute for Public Policy. Thanks, gentlemen, to both of you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, Joe Negri has appeared with Tony Bennett, Itzhak Perlman, Yo-Yo Ma, Branford and Winston Marsalis. But to many, he's still known as Handyman Negri, and he's still playing and teaching at age 92. And we'll find out about the condition of our urban soil, how it can impact everything from public health to urban agriculture. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.